Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. And we're continuing our coverage of the Association of the United States Army's annual meeting, this year conducted virtually under the title AUSA Now. Joining us is my good friend, former Deputy Defense Secretary Bill Lynn, who is now the President and CEO of Leonardo DRS. Bill, thanks very much for joining us.
Great to be with you, Vago.
And before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. That's also helping sponsor our AUSA Now coverage. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. And Beretta USA is also sponsoring our AUSA Now as well as land warfare coverage. Bill, thanks very much again for joining us. It's been a little while since we've spoken to one another. You know, we don't live far apart from each other, but obviously these are extraordinary times, and folks are tending to stay a little lower than they otherwise might. Talk to us a little bit about COVID. Obviously, it's affected everybody. It's driven borrowing at a rate that we haven't seen certainly in a very, very long time, even though this has been a very, very bumpy road in terms of getting this fourth stimulus package through. Talk to us about how this pandemic has actually or stands to potentially change permanently how Leonardo DRS operates and how you do business, because we've heard time and again from senior Pentagon officials that they think this is an excellent opportunity to rethink how much travel is enough travel, how much office space is necessary, what are some innovative ways that we could be doing things, do we need to certify a ship with 12 people, or can we do it with one or two people? How is it, in your sense, as somebody who's got always a strategic view of these things, changing how it is you guys are going to be operating well beyond the end of this pandemic?
Well, Vago, I think it's going to go as you indicated. People are going to use this as a learning experience whenever we come out of it, which I don't think is all that soon. But it's going to mean that we're going to take more extensive use of work from home opportunities. There's going to be fewer people working out of the office, or at least working every day out of the office. We're going to be relying more on virtual events like the AUSA we're in the midst of now, a virtual AUSA. There's, I think, going to be fewer live trade shows. I think that goes to how do you provide information? How do you get data to people? How do you give people the information they need to make decisions? I think that's all moving towards a virtual environment, or more so. I think you have to, though, keep in mind that part of the reason people travel and go to trade shows and do interviews with people such as yourselves is the personal relationships. And I think the question I think is going to come is to how do you build personal relationships if you're relying on a virtual world to transfer information? At least I haven't seen it yet. I think it's much harder to develop a personal relationship on Zoom than it is at an air show or an in-person trade show like AUSA. So I think it's going to be, there's more creative thinking needs to be given to how do you target that travel? How do you create those personal relationships that are the foundation of a lot of our business and a lot of other businesses? I don't think you can do everything virtually in that regard.
There's a big debate among senior executives whether this is that this kind of distributed operation and less travel actually is making people more productive. And then there are others who say, it's kind of a trade-off. In some ways, you're less productive than being in an office. On the other hand, in some ways, you're more productive, right? People don't have, for example, an hour and a half or 3 hours they may devote to a commute. That becomes work time. People aren't traveling as much. they're attending more virtual events. So there are some people who've told me they feel more plugged in some respects than they did otherwise. Where do you fall on all of these trade-offs? And do you think at the end of the day, people are being as effective as they were, or effective but differently?
I mean, I think people are more productive in a kind of a narrow efficiency calculation. As you said, you can do more events, you have less transfer time. So I think that there are opportunities there. I also think you lose that personal interaction. A lot of times the most important part of a meeting for me is the after meeting, where you go down the hall and talk to a couple of key people and say, okay, what did we actually get out of that briefing?
Right.
It's not the briefing itself, it's that interaction. Now, you can do that with a phone call or a Zoom call or whatever, but it's not quite as, to use your word there, as efficient. I don't think that works as well. I also think it's broken down the demarcation between work and home. And I think people use that commute to decompress, to change their mindset. And so I think it's creating, I'm seeing in my managers more stress, less separation from the work, which is not entirely good. I mean, it's great people are on top of what they're managing. On the other hand, you need people to be able to decompress and recharge, as it were. And I think it's in this world, this virtual world, it's harder to do that. I think you can find ways to do it, but I think it's more challenging than in a traditional work environment.
Let's go to the issue of the budget outlook. It's certainly an interesting time in Washington. Obviously, national elections and key elections for the future of the House and Senate. COVID has cast a long shadow on that. And given the trillions of dollars that have already gone to stimulus and the extraordinary amounts, I think people have a tendency of forgetting the separate amount of money that the Fed has been deploying in order to keep markets buoyed at the end of the day. I know that, you know, you are a senior former, or I should say a Democratic senior former official, your last role being the Deputy Defense Secretary. But now you don't have any partisan affiliation or don't have any partisan work that you're doing. And so there's a big debate about what happens no matter who wins, whether it's Trump 2 or whether it's Biden 1. We've heard from the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, Adam Smith, who said, look, even though there's a very strong bipartisan support for defense spending, progressives will make a play to reduce defense spending. On the other hand, you even talk to some GOP insiders who say, well, you know, if Biden wins, then we're going to get more focused on deficit reduction, right? I mean, again, putting us to the BCA kind of default threshold that we saw. As you're looking at all of these tea leaves, as somebody who has experience in the department, in industry, and up on the Hill working once upon a time for Senator Kennedy, how do you see this playing out? Like, what are your projections on what the outlook for defense spending is in that near to mid term?
Well, Vago, I think actually kind of the political landscape is the least determinative factor in the defense budget. I think you see budgets go up under Democratic administrations, down under Republicans, or the reverse. I think it isn't a given that what party controls the levers of power in Washington, that determines where the defense budget's going. I think the two much bigger factors in where the defense budget is going are, one, the deficit, and two, the threat. And I think in this case, they are countervailing. The deficit is getting very large. The tax cuts increase the deficit substantially. The continued growth in entitlement programs has been a long time a driver of increases in the deficit. And now we've got the added the stimulus from COVID of several trillion dollars has at least given a one-time shot to the deficit. All of that's going to be, I think, a gravitational pull on defense spending, no matter who's elected. Trump or Biden. There isn't going to be that much money to go around to add to defense. There's going to be other claimants, and there's going to be this looming deficit that's going to constrict all spending. And the fact that we're at an all-time peacetime high in defense spending just reinforces that. On the other hand, the other factor is the threat. And the threat's not going away. Indeed, it's increasing. It's increasing in the form of the strength of the Chinese economy and the growth in their military. We have not contained the North Korean threat, even a little bit, I think. That's growing. There's still great uncertainty about Iran's intentions in the Gulf and then the broader Middle East. So I think you're seeing the threat growing. And so I think that's a countervailing threat on the deficit. And I think where it nets out is there's not going to be a lot of appetite to cut defense spending dramatically, again, no matter who's elected. And there's not going to be a lot of money available to increase defense spending. And so I think it's the two are going to negate each other to a degree. And we're going to see relatively flat spending for the near and midterm on defense.
And right. And then the concern that some people have is that this could actually become a net sort of cut, right? Because if you look at internal inflation, and if it's not adjusted for inflation in terms of where that top line goes, then actually you're eating the budget out from the inside. What are your expectations about that, right? I mean, it, to anybody but a budget wonk, and I know you're a budgeteer of the first order, so why I'm asking you this, right? That's a seemingly small, wonky issue that's actually a lot of money on a $750 billion plan.
No, I think you're absolutely right. When you see flat budgets, and as you indicated, I've been in the Pentagon a couple of different times where we've seen flat or declining budgets, and what that means is trade-offs. Is that you need sustained growth in the defense budget in order to accommodate all of the underlying structural growth, the cost of living increases, the pay increases, the increased cost of technology, all that moves at several percent a year. So as you just said, if you have a flat budget, you're actually eroding your program. That's what's happening, is you can't, the cost of the program goes up year over year. If the budget doesn't move at that pace, which I don't think it will, you're gonna see trade-offs. So you're gonna see trade-offs between force structure and modernization. You're gonna see trade-offs between procurement and R&D, or you could call that today versus tomorrow. You're gonna see whoever's elected, I think you're gonna see a big push to get more efficiency. So whenever you have this kind of budget, people are going to look around for more efficiencies in the budget. How do we do things in a more efficient way, freeing up resources to pay for the things that we want to add? The challenge I've always thought with those efficiencies is we tend to take the biggest things off the table because they're politically fraught. We don't want to touch military pensions. We don't want to touch medical costs. We don't want to touch base structure. There's good reasons for those things. On the other hand, that is where the money is. And so if you're looking for efficiencies and you take those things off the table, those efficiencies are very hard to find.
So what's the right way to do this, right? I mean, so Seth Moulton, the Massachusetts Democrat, and Jim Banks, the Indiana Republican, and other members were all equals in the Future of Defense Task Force. They've spoken very, very thoughtfully, as Congressman Moulton told us, you know, you've got to bring all three elements of the military industrial congressional complex together to make these trade-offs, right? And it more than any other time in my career, people are actually talking about the importance of actually making trade-offs. You had a couple of turns at making those trade-offs. I mean, you were PA&E, then PA&E, now CAPE, at the department at the end of the Cold War, where the Clinton administration was making trade-offs and defense spending was being reduced. And there was PAYGO and all of the other kind of deficit reduction mechanisms that were in place. You and I would talk occasionally in stairwells, if I recall, to talk a little bit about what was happening and how. And then you came back as Deputy Defense Secretary when the Obama administration did terminate, actually, very large programs, whether F-22, Future Combat Systems, Airborne Laser, and others. Do Banks and Moulton have the right approach in terms of how to do these trade-offs? Because lawmakers have, you know, I mean, the Army a couple of times did produce proposed cuts. You know, let's not do a Block 2 Chinook. Lawmakers saw it differently, just like the Air Force wanted to get rid of the A-10 and lawmakers forced the Air Force to keep the A-10. What's the right way, as somebody who's now spent time in each of these three complexes, what's the right way to go about to make these trade-offs?
I mean, I believe in that the executive branch has to lead. That the decisions or the proposals have to come from the Department of Defense and the White House. But you have to build support for those proposals among the other two elements you're saying. You have to get industry to come along, and most importantly, you have to get the Congress to come along. I mean, we had several successful base closure rounds. We certainly need another one. So you have to get the administration, whichever party is going to lead it, is going to have to take the action to move that base closure round, but they have to gather congressional support. So it's a matter, I think the two congressmen have it right in that you need to get all the stakeholders in the room, as it were, and bring them along. But you're not going to, the room isn't going to set the agenda, the administration does. And then you have to sell that and maybe modify it to sell it. But the leadership has to come from the department and the White House.
Let me ask you a little bit about, to shift a little bit more to your corporate portfolio, obviously the CEO of an important company in the ecosystem. The department keeps talking about doing things fast, and you and I used to talk about the issue of fast. And fast matters if you actually know where you're going. And right now, even people in the department will say it's really good that we're doing, for example, next generation air dominance and turning it from a design into a flying article quickly. The question is that there are so many things that are moving fast. Are you actually sort of fighting against yourself? And in your case, as a CEO, you're willing to go fast on the other and invest money as long as there's a payoff at the end of that somehow. You know, as opposed to a department pressuring everybody to sort of do projects for the sake of projects that don't have a clear road to somewhere. What do we need to be getting right? And what is some of the feedback that you're giving the department as you see this stuff and your own appetite to invest, to be fast, to bring ideas, right? You've got to see some sign that that's going to be rewarded. So I'm sort of interested in your take on, you know, how to be looking at this ecosystem and maybe get it more finely tuned to achieve what the department wants to achieve, as opposed to, you know, like, how do you get there?
Well, I mean, I think you're right. It's you know, speed can be a two-edged sword. You know, going fast if you don't know where you're going is not really a good thing. But I think you need to differentiate between the speed in the process. In other words, I think I used to say when I was in the department, it would take me 2 years to get a budget for something. And in that time, Steve Jobs, you know, invented the iPhone. So the process was or is takes too long. Just go through the steps of budgeting, setting requirements, putting proposals up. Getting speed of process, I think, is almost always a good thing. Whether you want to move those technological developments fast. That, I think, is it depends on the technology, depends on how mature it is. You can't outrun the science. But what you want to do is spend your time on the science, not on the process. And I think we've had a recent success here with this approach, in that the Army actually just announced the contract to General Dynamics for the IM SHORAD, that short range air defense system. We Leonardo DRS provides the mission equipment package for that. That in less than 2 years has gone from PowerPoint to hardware on the ramp, on a very urgent need, countering unmanned aerial systems that the Army has. So that's, I think, where an example of where speed was put to very good use, and the Army minimized the process slowdowns and gave us the time that we needed to put the technology in the field.
Do you feel comfortable at this point? Right. The problem historically has been that if a company builds a better mousetrap and brings that mousetrap to the attention of the Pentagon, decades ago, the Pentagon may have bought that. But now the Pentagon looks at it, crafts a requirement, competes it, and then actually the first mover in terms of the advantage loses 3 or 4 years, as you said, right? Look at me. I developed an iPhone. And then by the time it gets requiremented and everything else, the person who actually came up with the innovation could end up losing it. What are the changes that have to happen to encourage you to make that investment, to bring the product and actually sell it to the department without it, you actually losing that advantage, dating the technology, right? And I understand how everybody in this ecosystem, by the way, games this to make sure that the guy who's got the advantage doesn't end up with a contract, sadly. But, how do we need to think about that from a department
it's
standpoint?
It's complex, I think, Bago. I mean, in the commercial world, staying with the iPhone, Apple develops the iPhone. They spent all the money on the R&D and they own the intellectual property. And so they took all the risk and they get all the reward. That's the way it ought to be. In Department of Defense, the department often pays a lot of the development costs. So you can't quite say the company has taken all the risk. On the other hand, you can end up in the position that you've just said, where a company uses some of its own resources to develop something, or uses a combination of government resources and its own to develop something. And then it doesn't control the intellectual property. The department decides to compete it, and you lose the value of that investment. I mean, there's an argument on both sides that right. The government certainly deserves, some part of that intellectual property for its investment. On the other hand, you have to have a system where the company is going to be rewarded for its side of the investment. So it's you have to balance that in a way that you don't have to in the commercial world.
You mentioned IM SHORAD. Obviously, MFOX, IM SHORAD have been are important programs. When you joined the company, there were a couple of good years, and then, of course, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan started drawing down. So revenue went from about $3 billion a year down to $1.8 billion. And you did some very active portfolio shaping, got some big wins, again, under your belt, and now you guys are back up to that $3 billion mark through key wins. As you look at your strategic portfolio, where does the company need to be 5 years from now? What are the capabilities that you think you need? And conversely, what are some things that you might need less of as you prepare yourself for this great power future that may have very, very different requirements from what it is that we've been buying over the past 20 years, that will have very different requirements?
Well, Vago, as you said, we before I got to the company, we had grown substantially, largely in the Army business and heavily dependent on wartime spending in Iraq and Afghanistan. And as those wars wound down, our revenue base, of course, fell, as you described. When I got there, we tried to rebuild, and part of rebuilding, and it's part of where we want to go in the future, to answer your question, is we diversified. We are still a very strong Army company. company, but now we're nearly as strong in the Navy and have a growing airborne and satellite communications business as well. So we've diversified, and we think to continue the growth that we've had over the past several years that's kind of restored our position, we need to maintain that diversity. We want to continue to grow. We think that we want to stay in the weight class that we're in. We're happy, even though there are fewer mid-sized defense companies than there once were. We think it's a competitive advantage. We think that we've got a leaner cost structure, a more agile decision-making process, and that we talked about IM Shored. We're able to produce things to the customer's requirements and desires at a faster pace because of the nature of the company. So as we look forward, we want to retain that mid-tier position and not, you know, we're looking to grow, but we're not looking to change our weight class.
Well, what are the, you know, you're a unit of Leonardo Group that is a global company with extraordinary technology across the portfolio from the highest end combat aircraft side, obviously a critical partner in the F-35 program, but also on the Eurofighter program. And obviously Leonardo is also partnered with the United Kingdom on its Tempest program, along with Sweden as a partner nation, Italy as a partner as well. A few years ago, that kind of pushed push-pull relationship was manifested by bringing the M-346 trainer by Leonardo Aircraft to the United States for the U.S. Air Force's trainer competition as the T-100. And the Leonardo CEO, Alessandro Profumo, has sort of said, like, look, we exist here to, you know, develop the technologies, obviously mind our businesses, but empower our leaders to tap those markets around the world on a frontline basis. Talk to us a little bit about the push-pull nature of the relationship you have and how Leonardo itself is resetting for this new global environment in terms of the investment it's making that will be paying not just Leonardo DRS dividends, but actually whatever customer you have here gets to benefit from that investment that's being made at the parent company.
Mm-hmm. Well, as you know, Leonardo has evolved over the last decade from a European-focused multi-sector conglomerate more to a global aerospace and defense company. DRS was an important part of that evolution. You're not a global aerospace and defense company if you don't have a position in the U.S. market. And with DRS, as well as some of the electronics and particularly the helicopter business, we now have a very strong position in the U.S. market, and that global footprint has then enabled Leonardo to contribute across the board. So it's now a part of the F-35 program, as you described. It's a part of the Tempest program. It has now significant positions across the perimeter of defense positions, and it's now in a focused way been able to bring the technology base that it's developed to bear on the technological needs of a variety of global military.
Let me ask you a merger and acquisition question. Obviously, whenever you're in a period like this of a certain budgetary uncertainty, you know, market shifts, right? We hear increasingly from the Pentagon about the need for new competitors. So that could drive a merger and acquisition wave. Do you think that there is going to be an M&A wave? And if so, do you see Leonardo playing in it the way that you guys pretty consistently have, both as DRS, but also as Leonardo DRS?
Well, I mean, from our perspective, we're always trying to actively shape our portfolio and looking for acquisitions that will not so much widen our participation in the market, but more deepen in the markets we're already in. So we're actively looking for opportunities. In terms of the broader market, is there going to be another Last Supper or something? I think we've already gotten down to a relatively small number of large primes. So I think we're not in the situation we were in the early 90s. So I think there's always a possibility that you'd see some consolidation, but I think the room for maneuver there is much, much less than it was in the past.
Just very briefly, and I know I sort of touched on this, any sense at this point about where you think you're going to be putting that investment in shaping the portfolio? I mean, what are the areas where you're going to be maybe investing more and maybe some other areas where maybe will not feature as prominently in your thinking?
Well, I mean, I think we're going to continue to invest in our strengths. So that, you know, whether it's sensors for the individual soldier or for vehicles or for helicopters or network computing and fusing all of the various sensing inputs and communication inputs into a more integrated whole or global satellite communications, naval power propulsion. I think those are all areas we'll continue to invest.
Bill, always a pleasure talking to you. Sadly, we're not seeing each other face to face in order to do this interview, but I truly appreciate the time. All the best. Break a leg at the AUSA Now coverage and looking forward to talking again soon. And certainly very much looking forward to having John Baylouny on the program to get into the mechanical details of some of this. Thanks again.
Thanks, Vago. Always great to talk to you.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.